the Pope, who is the head dude of the church, yeah. is saying, you know what? Insofar as we have licensed domination, we have been wrong, and we need to go back and we need to do better.
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Laudato Si, on Care for Our Common Home, Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment came out in June 2015, a few months before the Paris Climate Agreement. Pope Francis's letter to all of humanity presents an urgent challenge to respond to the dual, and indeed related, crises of poverty and environmental degradation, including climate change. I'm willing to wager that you're going to want to read it by the end of this episode, if you haven't already. I'll put up a link to the full text on our website, in-the-weeds.net, as well as links to other readings and information about people and events that come up in our discussion. To help us make sense of the encyclical, I spoke with Christiana Zenner, Associate Professor of Theology, Science, and Ethics in the Department of Theology at Fordham University. Her research focuses on freshwater ethics. She is the author of Just Water, Theology, Ethics, and Global Freshwater Crises, and is a leading expert on the ecological turn in Catholic social teaching.
So I have to say, I was kind of blown away by the encyclical. I mean, I don't know if I've read any other Pope's encyclical, so I don't have a lot to compare with, but it was quite the experience. So let's start, just for those who aren't familiar with the Catholic tradition, could you explain what an encyclical is?
Absolutely. And I love your line that you hadn't read one before, because they're not generally a reader-friendly genre. They are a type of letter that is written by the Pope in consultation with bishops whom he selects, and they're oriented around a particular theme, usually having to do with theology of the Catholic Church, or morality, or increasingly social, economic, and political issues. Since 1891, there's been a tradition called Catholic social teaching, which is formal papal reflection in the genre of an encyclical on matters of social, political, economic, and now environmental concern. And so that's where this document, Laudato Si, sits in a genealogy. Just as a side note, encyclical is a term for the kind of document, not because it's inherently circular or anything like that, but simply because in the way that these documents are disseminated, they're meant to be circulated by the Pope and then amongst the bishops. And so it's an idea of a circular letter, a letter for conversation and moral reflection.
Let me ask you something just very simple. How do they get circulated? I was actually telling my daughter about the interview on the way to school, and I mentioned the fact that it's addressed to all people, and that's one of the things that's striking about it. And she said, well, what about people who don't have internet? That was an interesting question.
That's such a great generational question. Pope Francis is actually, in my understanding, the first pope to release this encyclical in little bits over Twitter. So he is a very tech-savvy pope. Previous popes, or maybe we should just say their media offices, like Benedict XVI and before him John Paul II, used the internet as a mechanism of dissemination. But prior to that, and even since the internet, the basic dissemination mechanism has been actually sending copies of the thing to regional bishops' conferences. So, for example, the bishops in the United States get a series of copies with a note from the Pope and the various bishops he's working with in Rome. Same with those in the Amazon, same with those in Asia, and so forth. So, you know, the mode of transmission has shifted a little bit. And I think what your daughter's picking up on so aptly is that with the internet, there is a democratization of access, at least for those who can afford and have internet access and a computer. And so part of what has shifted is that more people are interested in these documents, especially ones that talk about the environment or social justice, or both in the case of Laudato Si, even if those people aren't Catholic. So what you picked up on earlier in terms of the letter being addressed to all people on this planet, that's both in keeping with Catholic tradition, which in this tradition of Catholic social teaching since 1891 has addressed all men and women of goodwill quite frequently. But something that Pope Francis did that was new is he said, you know what? I'm actually just writing this to everyone. This is addressed to all people on the planet because this is a general problem.
So this is unique in that respect.
It is.
Okay, that's interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the Pope himself. He's the first Pope to take the name Francis after Francis of Assisi, whom he quotes in the opening line of the encyclical, and who is thought of as the patron saint of animals and the natural worlds. How do you see that as significant?
Well, he's actually also, St. Francis is the patron saint of ecologists and has been in the Catholic Church since the late 70s or early 80s. What I think is significant about this pope, not to be confused with the saint, who chose the name Francis, is that it's really clear that when he was elected in 2013 to the papacy, he had a lot of energy behind the dual concerns of environmental degradation and lives of the poor and how those interact. And so questions of marginalization, questions of looking to the poor and to the environment as sources of value and as increasingly marginalized and overlooked, especially in global economic structures, is a central charism of his papacy.
You use the word charism a lot. Can you define that for us?
That's good Catholic world speak. Thank you for calling me on my theology professor proclivities. Charism simply means one's orientation or vocation. And so it's you might think of it as the kind of ethos or the kind of gifts that one brings to a particular job. You know, each of us have different energies and different cares and different passions in what we do in our daily lives and how those manifest and what kinds of themes keep coming up for us in our work and in our daily lives, whether you're at home, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a business person, that can be thought of as your charism. What really motivates?
Do you find that you end up translating some of these terms to other contexts? Like, do you think about what your charism is, for instance?
Oh, interesting question. Yeah, I do. I do. And you know, sometimes theological terms are really beautiful and metaphoric and open up expansively. And sometimes I find them very constraining and stultifying. As an aside, I'm a little bit of a quirky theology professor because my background is in human biology as an undergrad. And then I did a PhD in religious ethics after finishing a master's in ethics. And the reason for this is that when people make decisions or actions or lifestyle choices or relationship choices about consumption, about the environment, about beginning or end of life care, about any of these ethical issues, you know, we turn to the moral traditions that have shaped us. So one of the things I noticed when working on my dissertation, which was on the values of fresh water in a global economy and the ethics of that, one of the things I noticed was that the Catholic Church had really started advocating strongly for the articulation and the passage of a human right to water at the United Nations. And so that's really how I got into, you know, a theology position and being what I sometimes tongue-in-cheek refer to as an accidental expert on the Catholic Church's turn to ecology.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's interesting, too, because that bridging of science and ethics and religion is very much baked into the encyclical itself, and that in terms of sort of making sense of it and sort of teasing out the different parts of it, you're forced to always think about how are these relationships being articulated, you know, how is this working, this dynamic?
Absolutely. And as listeners will surmise, the Catholic Church has a modeled history in relationship to modern science. You know, there's some really problematic points. We can think of Galileo or Giordano Bruno, but we can also think of the Catholic Church as being one of the more surprisingly progressive voices on matters of evolution in particular, which surprises a lot of people. But there is, especially in the late 20th and now early 21st century, there's a lot of energy behind papal consultation with the Pontifical Academy of Sciences and the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences, which are bodies that were developed in the 20th century, to bring together Nobel laureates, scientists, and so forth to advise the popes and the heads of the Catholic Church on these matters of science, and then to facilitate reflection on faith and morality.
So in this respect, Pope Francis is continuing in a tradition. What he's doing is not a notable departure.
Yes, that is such a great point. And it's one that after the encyclical came out in 2015, I found myself saying over and over again is, yes, he is doing this in his own particular way, his charism, we might say. Mm-hmm. But he is also building on the legacy of Benedict XVI, who was very skeptical of some of the excesses of economic globalization and the ways in which that led to marginalization of people in poverty and to environmental degradation. He's building on the legacy of John Paul II and even Paul VI, but he's also building on these structures within the Catholic Church that are about dialogue and consultation with the most advanced forms of science and knowledge in the social sciences. And, you know, I think part of why Pope Francis has gotten so much attention is that this encyclical is the first encyclical to really centralize ecology as a concern. Others have talked about the environment, but ecology as a set of relationships, as concern about the natural world and social justice front and center, that's the new thing. And honestly, I also think that people just relate to Pope Francis, you know? They like him. Yeah. They like him better and differently than other popes.
That's true. I'm just going to grab my copy of the encyclical here. I'd like to just look at the very opening of it. I'm going to maybe just read the first paragraph. So, Laudato si, am I pronouncing that right?
Laudato si, mi signore.
Laudato si, mi signore. Praise be to you, my Lord. In the words of this beautiful canticle, St. Francis of Assisi reminds us that our common home is like a sister with whom we share our life and a beautiful mother who opens her arms to embrace us. Praise be to you, my Lord, through our sister, Mother Earth, who sustains and governs us and who produces various fruit with colored flowers and herbs. So he's quoting Francis of Assisi there. So I wanted to talk, I mean, you write about this as well, but I wanted to talk about the feminization of the earth here, which is one of the things that's kind of striking in the beginning. The analogy of a sister and a mother. What do you make of that?
Oh, I have so many thoughts on this. True disclosure. When in 2015, I got an advanced copy of this before it was released to the press and the public. It was not long before it was released, but enough that
How do you get on the list?
Was a good question. I don't know how I got on the list for this. It wasn't a super early advance copy. I was not consulted. I was not one of the people who was contracted to think through some of the issues or ethical framings. There were people in the process of writing the encyclical who did serve as those consultative experts, because encyclicals of this type tend to be jointly written and approved and revised by the Pope, simply because he wants to rely on experts who have dedicated their lives to thinking through these kinds of issues. In my case, I was given an advance copy through Jesuit media channels and also the Washington Post, who wanted a particular take on what this encyclical might mean, which, you know, when you get it 18 hours before it goes live, is a fairly intense undertaking, given how long some of these documents can be. And circling back then to the question of the opening lines of this encyclical, it is quoting the Canticle of St. Francis, this poem attributed to St. Francis, that is rapturous about the beauty of the natural world, the wisdom of the natural world, and, as you pointed out, the intense feminization of the natural world. When I first got the copy of the encyclical, I opened it, you know, thinking, oh my gosh, this is so fascinating and bizarre and exciting to be in this position, to have this oddly situated knowledge, to be able to interpret this document. I wonder what it's going to say. And I opened it and I read that. And then I read the next section about the ways in which the mother has been wasted and the sister exploited and abused. And my anxiety went through the roof and I had to shut the copy of the encyclical and put it down for a little while. That has many tendrils. I think that for me in that moment, what I was responding to was the ways in which patriarchy continually images nature in ways that are useful to structures of domination, and the ways in which women's bodies and the earth have been dominated or imaged in ways that are means to particular male, often structural ends. Part of what I was also grappling with and have been grappling with since then is that while this imagery opened the encyclical, for the most part, it is not taken up later on throughout the encyclical. So there's this highly gendered language with the language of abuse and neglect, and then it's dropped. And there is so much to say about that in a church that is heteropatriarchal, in a world that is beset by gender inequalities that link to all forms of injustices, that I just had this gaping ache that I knew that would not be a thread that was sufficiently carried through. Now, in the encyclical, the Pope does say a number of things about, for example, the feminization of poverty, the effects of lack of fresh water on women and girls and the elderly and children in particular, and that's commendable. But I think that we also have a lot of work to do in terms of thinking about gender and the earth and the ways in which these images so easily tossed around do and do not communicate sufficiently.
Okay. So I'm going to start with a pretty broad question, which is, what do you think is most radical about this encyclical, and what do you think is the most conservative about it?
Great question. What I think is most radical about this encyclical is the papal turn to the value of indigenous ecological knowledge. Now, this is a place, actually, where the Pope does bring up again the feminization of the earth in a way that honors a number of indigenous ecological imagings and understandings of the earth as mother. But when I was first reading the encyclical, I was really heartened and really surprised to see this move. It occurs in a couple of different paragraphs. Just as an aside, for those of you who might cite an encyclical someday, you don't cite it by page number, you cite it by paragraph number. So in a number of different paragraphs, the Pope turns to the value of indigenous cultures on their own, as well as to the value of indigenous ecological knowledge as a particular situated set of knowledge about environments, ecosystems, and cultural values. And he talks about how the extirpation of an indigenous culture is as problematic and as tragic, is the word he uses, as the extinction of a species. He also is, very importantly, and this is part of what makes it radical, implicitly undermining a project that's at least 500 years in duration of colonization, of religious universalization. And as Bill McKibben, the environmental activist and author, wrote in the New York Review of Books in 2015, this is a pretty radical move for the head of an institution that first set out to universalize the world. I agree with that. And a solid part of my thinking and writing subsequent to this has been, okay, what does it mean for the head of a global, hierarchical Catholic Church that did at one point set out to universalize the world? What does it mean for the head of that to turn to indigenous value systems, plural, because indigeneity is not homogenous? What does it mean for the Pope to do that? What are the possible positive outcomes, and what are the real dangers to which this could fall prey, given the dynamics of power and the legacies at play? And I think it's part of a bigger conversation about colonial and decolonial moves in ecological justice more generally, and I think it's a story that's still being written. But the Pope, in this encyclical, made very new room for that conversation in ways that I didn't expect, and I'm really pleased to see.
Can you relate that last comment to a specific situation, maybe something that he would have dealt with in South America, or, you know, when you're talking about like decolonization, for instance, and
Right. So I think as you've pointed out, given that this is a Jesuit Pope from Latin America, he has seen situations of cultural encroachment and environmental degradation that go hand in hand. And the plight of workers and inhabitants of Amazonia in particular, along with the degradation of the Amazon, has been a real concern for him for a long time. That manifested most recently in a synod on the Amazon, which just occurred this October in Rome, where representatives from the Catholic Church in the region, politicians, scientists, and inhabitants of the region, native Amazonian inhabitants, came to talk about culture, environmental degradation, and so forth. And so I think you're right that his geographic and cultural awareness, which is really different from those of us in North America, for example, and in some other parts of the world, I think that's part of what has helped him attune to these issues. At the same time, it's not an issue that is specific to, for example, Amazonia. It's an issue that applies in the United States, where, for example, we see conflicts over the idea of what kind of thing is water and who's responsible for protecting it. For example, at Standing Rock with the Lakota and Dakota Sioux and their contestations over pipelines.
Now, one of the things he does in the encyclical is to challenge the notion of private property, right? So there are certain specific situations. One of them pertains to water. And also, I thought it was really interesting, there's one passage in which he says that, you know, privatization shouldn't keep people from encountering especially beautiful places, which I thought was an interesting concept. That there's this sense that the earth is a common good and privatization needs to know its limits. How is that situated with respect to sort of Catholic dialogue more broadly? Or
that's a great question. And private property is a very long-standing and very hot topic in many discourses of political philosophy, including but not limited to traditions of Catholic moral reasoning. So going back to biblical sources, then also fast-forwarding, you know, 1,300 years to Thomas Aquinas and now up to today, there are many types of framings of when it is proper to have private property and when it's not allowed. And I think what the Catholic Church is arguing, somewhat counterculturally in the current neoliberal moment, is that there are some goods of the earth, goods of creation, as the Catholic Church would put it, because theological, there are some common goods, goods of creation, that are the patrimony of all, that conduce to the good of all human beings, and that cannot properly be owned by any individual. And water is the example that I have worked with a lot in my own work and thinking about the dynamics of water privatization and commercialization and commodification. But it's also the case that the Pope refers to the climate as a common good, clean air.
Right.
And the vagaries of climate change are things he's really concerned about. Now, he is drawing explicitly and implicitly in the footnotes on many, many years of papal reflection in this tradition of social encyclicals that I mentioned. He's also drawing on forms of political philosophy, a lot on Thomas Aquinas. Things always go back to Thomas Aquinas when it comes to justice and property in the Catholic Church. But I think that this particular angle of Catholic social teaching is so, so important in the particular moment that we inhabit, neoliberal, a particular kind of privatized political philosophy, where increasingly it seems to be one's own responsibility to provide a healthy environment for one's own family. And that is against much of the teaching of the Catholic Church, which holds that the idea of solidarity and the common good mean that we are all in this together and we have a responsibility to care for one another and, as the encyclical talks about, for the resources that facilitate flourishing. And so this is part of why, for example, the Pope talks about the human right to fresh water as a fundamental human right because it is essential for the fulfillment of all other rights. There are some things that are so vital and so distinctive that they cannot properly be privatized. It's a category error, almost.
Okay. I want to start to talk about the various things that he connects in this document. Structurally, to me, one of the most remarkable things about it is the ways in which he links the environmental crisis both to the social crisis and to sort of certain moral individual failings as well. So there's this sort of different tiers, but also this sort of sense of continuity. So for instance, you know, he says very bluntly at one point, there is not a separate environmental crisis and a social crisis. These are one crisis.
Yes, there is one crisis, social and environmental. Everything is connected.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's a really important refrain, because in the lead up to the release of this encyclical, a lot of people in the United States were, especially pundits, especially journalists, were all agog at the fact that this was going to be an encyclical about climate change, that the Pope was going to finally, you know, throw down his word and end some of these internecine, science-denying debates among Christians about whether climate change was happening. And the fact of the matter is, he didn't, because that's not the framing of the issue for him. For him, climate change is happening, and there are anthropogenic causes. The question is how these social and environmental degradations are linked together, both in terms of causes and in terms of uneven consequences. So one of the things that I always love talking with students through and seeing their impressions to is what's happening in the first chapter of the encyclical, because that's where the Pope really lays out some of his core theses and the lay of the land. Not only does he say, hey, this encyclical is to everyone, not just Christians, not just people of goodwill, it's to everyone, but he also says, you know what? Our common home is falling into disrepair. And if you're not sure about this, let me just give you 5 or 6 examples of how this is the case. The first is climate change and pollution. The second is water scarcity and degradation of water sources. There are a number of others, including global inequality. And so with this litany that he offers in the first chapter, he's demonstrating that all of these are cause for concern and that they are interwoven. It's not as if climate change and degradation of water supply is one issue over here, and then there's an issue of inequality over here. It's that they are all interwoven together, and part of the ethical, the moral challenge in the 21st century is to see the dynamics that cause and maintain these kinds of inequalities and to get to the root causes so as to remediate them to create lives of flourishing for people and the earth.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's woven into the language itself. I felt, for lack of a better word, shamed at points when I was reading it. You know, sort of not individually, but collectively almost. Like the passage in which he writes about how the pollution of the earth, let me see if I can find it actually. You know, let's see. Do you remember which paragraph it's in by any chance? The one
is it the one about our earth is turning into a giant pile of filth? Yeah.
Where he says the earth, our home, is beginning to look more and more like an immense pile of filth.
He's not
pulling his punches there. In many parts of the planet, the elderly lament that once beautiful landscapes are now covered with rubbish, industrial waste, and chemical products utilized in cities and agricultural areas, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I feel like that's significant, you know, that there's an emotional, there's an aesthetic dimension to the letter itself, which pulls at those strings. You know, it's not, this isn't just about the science. This is about our moral obligation.
Absolutely.
And in fact, the word sin appears at a couple of important moments in the encyclical. Can you talk about that and sort of flesh out What does sin mean? Like, how are we to understand that word specifically in the way that he uses it?
Okay, that is a great question, because this is a conversation that is ongoing in the Catholic Church. So first of all, you're really right to point out the kind of moral abrasion and the aesthetic pain and the ways in which a sense of guilt or shame, as you mentioned, is summoned by the Pope saying, folks, our planet is turning into an immense pile of filth. I mean, come on. And he uses the language of sin at a number of times in the encyclical. He uses the language of sin in a number of ways in the encyclical. And the use of the language of sin is what is currently in development in the Catholic Church. Again, not new to Pope Francis. It started before him. But one way that I think about it is that for much of Catholic and Christian history, sin has been largely understood as an individualized phenomenon. I do something to wrong you, it is sinful, or I do something to violate some kind of covenant with God, that is sinful. So our moral language has been between two agents of some sort, or at least the sin has been perpetrated by one agent onto another person who should be treated as a subject in their own right, who is, you know, full of dignity and so forth. What has happened, especially in the 20th century, is that there has been a recognition that sin is not always the result of individual agential decisions, that moral failings, or more strongly, moral sin, also have to do with the kinds of structures by which society orients itself and functions. And that's tricky, because if I am living in a society such as the one I inhabit, you know, New York City area in the United States, I am sitting atop enormous piles of privilege, colonization, that colonization has wrought, that fossil fuel extraction has wrought, that financialization of goods and services has wrought. And I don't necessarily choose to benefit from or participate in those. And yet, the fact that this is the way that global systems are set up often tends to mean that somewhere downstream, someone's life is negatively affected. Not necessarily directly, not necessarily intentionally, but yet there are these structures of sin. That's language that came out, especially of liberation theology in the latter part of the 20th century. A number of Protestant ethicists have been really, really great at talking about structures of sin and so forth. And it is now an idea that is coming formally into Catholic papal reflection, partly through this encyclical and partly through the Synod on the Amazon, which actually articulated a working definition of ecological sin.
Hmm.
And so this is, you know, sin is not really my jam as a theology professor. Others are much better versed at parsing the ins and outs of this. But I think it's a telling category. One of the notions that I think is most important in the encyclical as well that is related to this a little bit is not actually using the language of sin, but it's using the language of debt. The Pope uses the language of ecological debt and says that we in super-developed nations especially owe an ecological debt to people living in situations without sufficient fresh water or without sufficient goods to live. And so he is crafting a moral conversation in which there is a relationship between my privilege and someone else's oppression, even if it is not direct, even if it is not intended.
Hmm. That's very interesting. Part of what struck me reading the encyclical was this sense that, well, there's a lot of emphasis on the poor, right? This sense that, like, at no point can this be taken out of the equation. At no point can economic inequality be taken out of the equation. And, of course, that seems like something we can all agree upon when you're talking on a large scale, on a structural scale. But it seems like he's saying that on an individual scale as well. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And I'm glad you picked up on that, because I think it's one of the tensions in the encyclical is how do we hold all of these types of potential sin or potential responsibility and virtue together. And it's complicated. You know, the latter chapters of the encyclical variously talk about things individuals can do, the powers of business leaders to conduct their businesses in ways that have a different kind of ethics and integrity with regard to problems of poverty and environmental degradation. They talk about the vocation of political leaders, but they also talk about the imperative, really, of all of us not to lose hope and not to get bogged down in this, because one action does make a difference. And honestly, it's a really hard balance to strike. I don't know if it works. I mean, I feel this tension in my work almost every day, and it's exhausting. It is existentially exhausting to know cognitively the kind of world that we live in and the kind of systems upon which contemporary life is predicated, to want to do something to make it better, and yet to know that individual actions, while important for cultivating virtue and mindfulness and awareness and an ability to see dimensions of the problem, individual actions are not necessarily going to cause structural change. And that, I think, is one of the deep, deep existential problematics of people who are trying to live with integrity and do well in this particular moment, in the particular social location from which you and I speak.
That's a good point. I feel like he speaks to that in a way. There's a passage that I want to find. The passage on, oh, here it is. Okay. So it's in chapter one, where he writes, "Our goal is not to amass information or to satisfy curiosity, but rather to become painfully aware, to dare to turn what is happening to the world into our own personal suffering, and thus to discover what each of us can do about it." Mm-hmm. And I found that striking, and maybe I was reading too much into it, but part of what I thought is there is suffering. For anyone who is vaguely aware of what is happening to the world today, there's necessarily suffering. And I know that for myself, I struggle with that because it feels self-indulgent to give into those feelings, or potentially defeatist. And he doesn't want us to be defeatist, but there is this sense here that there's something, there's an agency or some kind of value in that suffering. And how do you understand what he means by the personal suffering here?
Well, that's interesting. I have never really been asked this question. And my first impulse is that, of course, the language of suffering and the idea of bearing one's own burdens and trying to alleviate others is deeply entwined in the Christian and particularly Catholic tradition. So liberation theologians, in particular, with whom Pope Francis has a substantial amount of familiarity with their work, talk about the ways in which patterning of oneself after the sufferings of Christ is really, really important. And there's one theologian in particular, Leonardo Boff, whose work is quoted, though not directly. He's summarized without citation. We might call that plagiarism in academic contexts, but in an encyclical, it's a head nod. His work talks about the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor. And so the idea of liberation theologians that Christianity, in this case Catholicism, and the church are called to go into the places where there is this suffering, the cry of the earth and cry of the poor, to take on and transform that suffering is part of what I hear in that passage.
Mm-hmm. It does sound very Christian, of course, in the whole notion of modeling oneself after Christ in some ways. So I feel like we should talk a little bit about his discussion of Genesis, in part because I had this previous episode with Rabbi Isaiah Rothstein, in which we were looking at the creation story in Genesis and the problem that Lynn White, among others, have posed, that this idea of man's dominion over creation sets a problematic precedent. And in fact, Lynn White sort of fingers Christianity more specifically because of the fact that God takes human form in Christianity. But Pope Francis vigorously fights back at this accusation, right? Is this fair? Yes and no.
Okay, Lynn White. Oh my goodness. You can't have a conversation about religion and ecology or environmental ethics in the West without talking about Lynn White. So I'm so glad you brought him up. Those, you know, eight or so pages published in 1967 in Science Magazine have given rise to so much reflection. And Lynn White, as a medieval historian, made the charge that Western Christianity in particular, in its highly technologized and eventually industrial forms coming out of the Middle Ages, is the most anthropocentric religion the world has ever seen. Side note, at the end of that article, he proposes St. Francis as a patron saint of ecologists, which then happened about 12 years later in the Catholic Church. So, you know, there's a lot of interconnection among these things. You know, I think there are some things that Lynn White aptly put his finger on, which is why that article has had such staying power. I think there are some things that he oversimplified. I think there are some absurdities. But nonetheless, this question of Western anthropocentrism and whether Western Christianity in particular has justified the degradation of the natural world because of a particular dominion theology or a philosophy of domination that we can see in lots of different thinkers, that's an enduring question. Why this is relevant to the encyclical is that in chapter two, Pope Francis takes on interpretations of Genesis. And so he goes from chapter one, where he says, okay, dear everyone, we've got some problems with our common home, to chapter two, where he says, and now this is for Christians in particular, because we need to rethink our interpretations of Scripture. What does Scripture say in Genesis about the relationship between humans and the natural world? How have we interpreted this over time? What might need to change? Now, as you've gone into greater detail with in other episodes, what Genesis says is a trick question, because there's a lot that Genesis says. There are two creation stories. There are numerous authors and viewpoints coming in. I think the salient question for Pope Francis and for the Catholic Church and for Christians today is, what sources from Genesis, what understandings of human relationship with the natural world are to guide us as we think forward about proper behavior and proper forms of relationship? In that chapter, chapter two, Pope Francis says, I think, at least two really important things. One is that the image of humans as those who till and keep the earth is the one that we need to hold up, that this is about, again, care for our common home, stewarding resources, not exploiting them. And secondly, insofar as an interpretation of Genesis as vindicating human domination of nature, insofar as that has been predominant, then we need to rethink it and we need to do better. So he is against what theologians call domination theology, that is the exploitation and domination of the natural world by human beings. He is for a kind of care and cultivate the earth, use the proper powers of humans in wise concert with this resource, this gift of God. But honestly, as someone who has been reading a lot of theology and ethics along with science for many years, what's radical about this chapter is that he says, oh shoot, Christian tradition may in fact have been wrong in overemphasizing this.
Yeah, you're right, actually, you're right.
I don't want to understate how important this is, because in a formal document with high authority in the Catholic Church, the Pope, who is the head dude of the church, is saying, you know what? Insofar as we have licensed domination, we have been wrong, and we need to go back and we need to do better.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I also, the sort of tilling of the earth part always rubs me slightly the wrong way.
Say more about that. What do you mean?
Well, just because I've studied some soil science and it turns out tilling really bad for the earth.
Oh, but, yes, absolutely. Yes, no till has real merits, for sure.
But one of the theological pieces that has to do with Genesis that I really liked is there are a couple parts where he essentially says, we have to remember that we are created, which means that we are creatures as well. Mm-hmm. Like, we have put too much emphasis on ourselves as agents. Mm-hmm. And not enough emphasis on ourselves as being created, as being mm-hmm. creatures, and thus sort of, I don't know if this is the way he put it necessarily, but part of the earth, part of creation as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice observation. And this turn to the creatureliness of humans is a move that's been happening in theology, in philosophy, in a number of other environmental studies discourses. The creatureliness of humans, distinct from what was a prior trend of the triumphalist, progressive, rational, technocratic capabilities of humans that were so vaunted from the Industrial Revolution through, say, World War II. And so reconnecting with the creaturely interdependencies, ecological, you know, in many ways, as well as other ways of thinking about it, is, I think, a very promising direction that a lot of people are going in. And so how do you hold together the fact that we humans do have a seemingly unique capability for self-reflection and also widespread destruction in the current moment? You know, we have certain forms of intentionality, and we are also embodied and creaturely and in relation with environments and subject to toxins and ecologies and systems. And we are not quite as independent from other critters and microorganisms and physical and geochemical processes as we might have thought. And so when we talk about anthropology, fancy way of saying what it means to be human and how we make sense of that, to bring in the creaturely is essential, because we are not you know, brains disassociated from our bodies. And, of course, feminist philosophy and some strains of environmental philosophy and many indigenous philosophies have known this for a long time. But it is also the case that when you have a pope with a very large pulpit, the message gets more permeation.
Yeah. It also, I feel like it strengthens the connections he makes between the individual, the social, and the environmental, mm-hmm. because as creatures, the health of the individual, the health of the community, the health of the earth, you know, it's sort of logical yeah. that they're all related to each other.
Yeah, I think that's really well said.
So we've touched on climate change a couple of times. Am I right to say that people were a little bit disappointed that it wasn't more explicitly about climate change?
I think that in the United States, there was an anticipation that the encyclical would be constructed along some of the fault lines of our particular culture wars. And so there was some surprise when it wasn't, when it was just noted that, yes, climate change and pollution are big deals and that there are anthropogenic causes to this. And also, let's move on because we've got stuff to deal with.
He does allude to climate deniers at one point, but what I found interesting about it is that he lumps climate deniers together with those who say, you know, it's too late, mm-hmm. there's nothing we can do, mm-hmm. And also those who are looking for sort of technological silver bullet to solve the solution. So mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of a deft move, you know, to mm-hmm. sort of address climate deniers, but say, look, there are a number of faults that are yeah. represented in terms of how people are responding to climate change.
Yeah, I think that that's an adroit observation because it makes the issue not into one of one's relationship to science in a particular U.S. political way, but it makes the issue about how one morally and existentially confronts the realities that are happening, you know? So as I think you're alluding to, there is a lot to be skeptical of in technocratic solutions that say, okay, we're just going to iron seed the oceans or silver nitrate the clouds, and then we'll solve this problem with geoengineering. One should be skeptical of that, just as one should be skeptical of those who say that there's absolutely no basis to climate science, because there is, and these are complex problems that need a lot of different resources for thinking about. Mm-hmm. And in a way, each of those approaches wants to make the problem simpler than it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, what have we yet to tackle? There's so much.
You know, I realize there is so much. One can keep talking for many years about such things. I realize that I didn't yet answer your question about what do I find to be most conservative
about
being cyclical.
Yes, I'm just thinking the same thing.
So what I find to be most conservative, if I had to choose one thing, I would say that this document does not really trouble long-standing Catholic understandings of nature. Nature in Catholic teaching for a very long time has been understood as, in many respects, one and indivisible, as revealing a design of truth and moral rightness. And there's a very strong tradition in Catholic moral reasoning called natural law moral reasoning, where one can look at the way things are in nature and have a refraction, not a direct reflection, but have a refraction of a sense of eternal or divine order and hence morality. Now, the concept of nature is highly fraught, as we know, in cultural studies and environmental philosophy and environmental studies, and rightly so. It is less fraught in Catholic teaching by a long shot. And while the Catholic Church has made some steps forward in thinking about the sciences and, in particular, planetary and natural sciences pertaining to the environment, where it has not made steps forward is in thinking about nature and the moral order of human relationships. What I mean is that there's this line, I think it appears in the encyclical, also Benedict, also John Paul II, that nature conveys a design of love and truth. And in chapter 4 of the encyclical, in his section on integral ecology, which is trying to link not just environmental ecology and the social sciences, but also morality of human relationships, there is an idea that male and female are created in a binary fashion, and that sexual natures are somehow linked to ecological natures. Now, there's a lot that we can say about that. There's a big history of conversation in this. There's a lot going on. But going back certainly to John Paul II and then definitely to Benedict XVI, there's a kind of assertion that human ecology, which includes sexual orientation and the heteronormative family, are somehow linked to natural ecology. So that comes out especially in Benedict XVI's 2009 encyclical Caritas in Veritate, that human ecology and natural ecology are linked. That comes out in chapter 4 of this encyclical, when Pope Francis talks about how it is not a wise or appropriate kind of questioning that would try to rethink gender maxims in certain ways. And it's subtle, but it's there. So for those who were looking for this encyclical to be not just a comment on climate change, but also a comment on human relationships, nothing is changing in this encyclical in terms of Catholic social teaching.
Do you think that could be partly strategic?
Yes. I think it could be partly strategic, but I also think it's because the Pope's not really going to change his mind on that.
I wanted to touch on one thing that you had raised earlier, and it was the question of universalism. And you said, of course, the word Catholic means universal, and you said that you feel that in his valuing of indigenous cultures, there's a departure from a certain form of universalism. I wonder if you see in the Pope's encyclical the substitution of a new form of universalism.
Great question. I think that the potential decline of a colonially infused universalism is a thing to be welcomed with open arms. Is it replaced by a universalism of another sort? I think you're right that this is the Pope. He's trying to speak to the global church, and as we've talked about several times, the entire world. So I think there is an optimism that what he says has the possibility of connecting with people, with everyone who bears the human countenance. And there's a kind of almost privileged hubris or naivete about that, you know, of course we can have this conversation. Why wouldn't we try? And there's something that I find heartening about that, even as recognizing the dynamics of global systems and legacies of extraction and corruption and everything else, it's an elusive goal. So I think there is universalism there. You know, I think one of the things that also comes through really clearly in the encyclical is Pope Francis's deep, deep-seated belief that humans are spiritual beings, and that regardless of one's particular creed, regardless of one of whether one is a theist, there are moral and spiritual truths on which we can connect. And so in chapter 6 of the encyclical, he actually gives several different prayers, those for theists, you know, some for Christians, some for those who do not necessarily ascribe to monotheistic traditions. And that's a slightly different kind of universalism. It's not prescriptive.
Universalism may not be the word then. It sounds more like an opening of sorts. Heartened is a word that I would use too. I guess one of the things that it made me think about is how a spiritual leader may be able to address the environmental crisis in a way that somebody who is not specifically addressing that aspect of human life can't, in a way. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, yes, I do. One of the most important journalists and moral thinkers on matters of climate change is named Eric Holthaus. And he has written for a number of different publications. He's now working with The Correspondent. He has, since I think 2015 or 2016, early on after the promulgation of the encyclical, has had pinned on his Twitter page as his primary tweet a quote from Pope Francis. And this is a person who has trained as a meteorologist, who is well-versed in the science, whose engagements are regularly on policy and numbers and science and economics. And yet that is the orienting tweet on his page. And so I think that what you've just said is entirely apt. I think that there is room for people who are seen as moral leaders or speaking from a realm that is one of empathy and ethics and care. It opens up conversations in certain ways. And frankly, I think we're seeing something very similar with Greta Thunberg, whose movement on school strikes for climate has galvanized so many people around the world of so many different ages. And she is increasingly seen as someone who can speak moral truths nonviolently to a world that is biased towards certain forms of privilege and can say, why are we doing this way? And I think that's the power of a moral or spiritual or charismatic authority, even if one doesn't set out to be one. You know, I don't think Greta Thunberg would ever say she set out to do what she has done, but that it has gained momentum because people have resonated with it in some way. And so I think there are those openings, and those bring me hope. But the challenge is, as we discussed a little bit previously, is that the journey is ever unfinished. There is not necessarily some endpoint where the problem will be solved and then we're done with it, right? There are always new iterations. And so how to sustain the energy and the care and the community for the journey is one of the questions with which we're left.
I hope you enjoyed our episode. For links to the full text of Laudato Si and other episode notes, go to in-the-weeds.net. Next time, I'll be talking to Amy Hall, VP of Social Consciousness for Eileen Fisher, about the fashion industry and the environmental and social cost of our clothes. I wish you all happy holidays. A little suggestion, give your friends and family a free gift they can enjoy guilt-free by telling them about this podcast. Thank you.